Hello, world. Welcome back to the sixth episode of the Hexen Cube podcast, a podcast where we talk about tabletop games and the community that gathers around them. Or doesn't gather around them if you are quarantined. I am your host, Kyle Schubert, and I am all by my lonesome again. As of the time I am recording this, much of the world is practicing social distancing in reaction to the current pandemic. It's a crazy time we are living in. Everyone's just trying to stay safe and keep their loved ones safe. So I am here, socially distant, recording this podcast. And in some ways, this podcast is a way for me to stay connected with other humans. So, hey, how are you doing? Tonight, we are going to be talking about board games. And specifically for our discussion topic tonight, we're going to be talking about deceptive games. Meaning, games that are not quite as they appear. But first, let's get into the news. Since the last podcast, I posted a written review of the game Wisdom of Solomon, which I mentioned before on the podcast, as well as an interview that I did with its designer, Philip DeBerry. He is a wonderful gentleman, and you should go check out those articles as soon as you are done listening to this episode. And please leave some comments. We'd love to hear from you on the blog. Additionally, I have been doing a lot more game design lately, and I've found an artist for my game, The Formative Years of Gallum Zeers, which I think that's the first time I've officially talked about the new name. It was formerly Mintrospection. It was a game that I had submitted to the Game Crafters Mint Tin Contest, and it has evolved a lot. And so I have decided to push ahead with the goal of self-publishing. So I'm going to run a Kickstarter for it. And I just got some initial sketches back for the art, and I think it's going to be sick. So keep your eyes open for more information on that. One of the ways in which you can do that is by letting me slip a tasty little email into your digital mailbox. Yes, I am soliciting email addresses. I'm not ashamed. If you are at all interested in getting cool updates from me, you can go ahead and sign up for our mailing list at the bottom of the blog homepage, hexencube.com. Down on the very bottom, you'll see a little entry field where you can enter in your information. Or you can just hit me up with your email on one of the social media platforms. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. I would greatly appreciate it. I promise I will not send you a bunch of stupid emails about nothing. One last thing I wanted to mention was that we were recently mentioned on Feedspot.com in a list of 40 tabletop gaming podcasts to check out in 2020. So that's pretty rad. I will post the link in the show notes so that you can go check out that site, as well as all the other great podcasts that are on the list. That is all I have for the news, so let's mosey on down to the game night segment. Due to social distancing, it has been way too long since I played a game with my boys, so mad love going out to them. I'm pumped for when this is all over and things go back to normal so we can get together and play some super awesome games. Alternatively and wonderfully, my wife has been more interested in gaming with me lately. I'm not sure if she just feels bad for me not being able to game with enthusiasts such as myself, or if she genuinely is enjoying it. But I think it's the latter, which is pretty awesome. We've been having a super great time playing games together lately. And we got through 3 new-to-us games this last week, which was super awesome for lots of different reasons. Trying to hit that 2020 resolution, getting through all my unplayed games. And so for the game night segment, I'm going to touch on all 3 of them. So the first game that we played early in the week was Bruges, which is a Steffenfeld design that came out in 13. The core of the game is this cool action selection system where you use these multi-use cards that interconnect to dice that are rolled at the beginning of each round. So basically, each round, players draw back up to a hand of five cards, so they'll always have five cards in their hand when they go to take their turn. And then five different colored dice are rolled. Each die with a result of five or six gives both players some kind of threat token, depending on the color of the dice that rolled those values. And then if a player ever gets three of one kind of threat token, something real bad happens to him. And these dice are all, each of the five dice are different colors. So, and then there's a track that can only be moved down immediately after the dice are rolled, the cost of which in coins is the sum of all dice that rolled a one or a two. So if two dice rolled twos and there were no ones, then to move up on the track one space, because you always move up just one space, you would need to pay four monies. So both players make that decision if they want to do that or are able to do that. And then once that's decided, players take turns using their cards to perform actions, playing one card at a time and then alternating turns. Each card has a color that corresponds to one of the five colors on the dice. And so each card can be used to do any of the six available actions, which include taking workers, taking money, mitigating a threat, building a canal, building a house, or hiring the character that's depicted on the card. But the effect of that action depends on the color of card being used when compared to the corresponding action. So, for example, if you use a yellow card to mitigate a threat, you can only mitigate the yellow threats, and so you just get rid of one of your yellow threat tokens. Or if you use a blue card to take workers, then you take blue workers, which you then use to build blue houses. If you use a red card to take money, then you get coins equal to the current value of the red die. There's some tableau and engine building, because you use the workers to build houses, and then you can put the people that are on your card into your houses, and they have effects that are like immediate effects or, you know, once per turn effects or end of game scoring kind of effects. It's all really streamlined and simple, in my opinion. For a Feld game, I thought that like the rule set is really light. Sometimes his rule sets are kind of crazy and confusing and heavy, but this was super simple, super light in terms of the actual rules, but the decisions feel really meaningful, and this game has some depth to it. Honestly, it's a really clever design. Feld is known for being clever. You know, a lot of his action selection mechanisms are really interesting, and he does a lot of clever things, and this is no different. So it fits right into the Feld philosophy of design. This is a lighter medium weight game, and I would be delighted to play it anytime. It was a great experience, and my wife loved the game, so that's always a plus. It's currently out of print, which is a bummer. So it may be hard for you to find, but if you can find a copy from one of your friends that doesn't like it, wants to get rid of it, on the geek market, I think it's definitely worth picking up. I bet if you waited, it probably will come back into print soon. I wouldn't be surprised if they did a reprint in the near future. But I loved it. Super good game, good experience, meaningful choices, clever design. Loved it. And that was Bruges by Steffenfeld. The next game we played was a game called Ulm by designer Günther Burkhardt, who also designed games like Sealand with Wolfgang Kramer, Maori, and Dragon's Breath, which was interesting to me, but that's one of our kids' favorite Haba games. It's a great game. But Ulm is mostly a linear victory point game, meaning, like, when it comes down to it, there's really not multiple paths to victory, or at least not to the extent that there are in many other Euro games that I would kind of put in the same weight class. But you are moving a barge down the Danube and placing seals in different quarters based on your position on the river. That was a mechanism that I liked. I liked the decision space of only being able to place seals and gain the bonuses of the quarters that were directly north and south of your barge. So where your barge was, that determined which quarters you could place your seals into and gain benefits. I think that's a cool idea. The other cool thing about the game is the action selection mechanism, which is this, it's this like 3x3 grid, square grid of action tiles. So the game starts with 9 action tiles. And at the beginning of your turn, you draw a random action tile out of a bag. Lame. But in its defense, there are a couple ways to mitigate the luck there. But then you place the action tile that you end up with into the grid, thereby sliding one of the other action tiles that's in the grid out of the grid. So then you take the 3 actions in the row or column that you just moved. The action tile that you placed, you'll be taking that action, and then 2 others that are left in the grid. And the one that you pushed out, you don't take that action. There's also this little economy between money and action tiles, because you can collect the action tiles that are pushed out of the grid and use them to get cards and the cards. So that's interesting, that little economy. But there's a lot of weight on the areas of luck that are in the game. And that's a big turnoff for me. For one, I don't really like luck in games at all. But if there is luck, I want like a lot of different ways or at least interesting ways to mitigate the luck. And I don't want the areas in which the luck affects, I don't want there to be a lot of weight riding on that part of the game. If it's a deciding factor in the game of who wins or loses, that's a big turnoff. And from what I experienced, that is definitely the case in Ulm. For example, the cards that you gain in the game, which is like one of the main sources of points, like you just gain them off the top of a face-down deck, which makes me cringe, honestly. Additionally, the board is super busy. Like the graphic design is in need of some serious contrast and organization. The way that things are laid out makes it difficult to like figure out where things are. Even late in the game, that's the case. There were some interesting things going on, like the action selection grid was interesting to me. The moving down the river and that whole decision space of deciding if you wanted to place a seal and get a bonus first before you moved. Or moving and then maybe opening up a new quarter for you to take a bonus in. That was all interesting. That was cool. But it didn't feel like it all came together in a cohesive unit. I'm glad that I played it to experience it and to kind of check out the mechanisms that were in the game. But honestly, I probably won't play it again. This one will probably end up on my trade stack, unfortunately. The last game we played was Coal Baron, the Great Card Game. Spoiler alert, it was not great, but they can call it that if they'd like. This is a Kramer and Kiesling design, which is what drew me to the game in the first place. Because of El Grande and how much love I have for that game, I always try to be optimistic about Kramer's designs. I always want to at least give them a chance. And I've discovered that because of that, I really love and enjoy some of his designs, and some not so much. And Colbert and the Great Card Game, unfortunately, would fit into the latter category. I thought, oh, cool, a Eurocentric train game that has been retrofitted into a simple but deep card game. Nah, dog. It was basically a drawn-out luck fest. I mean, like, it's a card game, so there's going to be some luck. It's to be expected. But dang. Just dang. The game was way too long at two players, and whoever had the right cards come up at the right time won. In my opinion, the only thing that was interesting or refreshing at all about this game was the worker placement mechanism. So each player has a hand of worker cards with different values. In a two-player game, you have something like 5 value 1 workers, I think 2 value 2 workers, and 1 value 3 worker. And then there's this whole middle, like, pool of different action spaces with decks of cards and action cards and stuff. And when placing a worker card at an action space, if the space is empty, you must place a 1 value worker to start it off. And then subsequently and sequentially, if anyone wants to take that action again, they must play the next higher value of worker, or a combination of workers that would equal that next value. So, you know, for example, if there was a 1 already in that action space, I could either play a 2 worker or 2 value 1 workers. That aspect of the game created some interesting choices for me, but unfortunately, it all resulted in a boring, luck-driven experience. There is one action that lets you mitigate some of the randomness, and you just have to fight over it, and that's what happens. And it just felt really uninspired to me. And it's a table hog, like, just for no good reason. Like, if there was something there, and you were doing interesting things, then great. Like, I love table hogs, but this one, I just wanted to, like, cook up, make some table bacon out of, or something. So, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this one. I would not recommend this game, nor do I ever want to play it again. I don't like to be negative and whatever, but it was just, I mean, my wife didn't really like it either, so, bummer. But, you know, you're going to have those. Not every game is right for every person, right? But I do hold to the idea that every game is right for someone. And, you know, this game is probably right for, like, you know, a couple people, probably somewhere in the world, just not for me. So, that's the game night section. Moving on, and on, and on, and on to our topic for tonight, deceptive games. Games that play differently than they appear that they would, and how expectation adds to or takes away from our experience with a game. I thought this was an interesting topic and an interesting conversation to have as I looked back on my history with games and thought about those experiences where I was expecting one thing and got another thing, whether that be pleasant surprise or a not so good surprise. For me, part of the enjoyment of a thing is the anticipation and kind of the expectation of that thing, whatever that thing may be. And so I think it's really important going into something to have a realistic expectation of that thing. And for some people, that's going in with no expectations and just whatever happens, happens, and just trying to enjoy it for whatever it may be. For me, I kind of like to expect things, but that is why it's key to have realistic expectations. So I wanted to first talk about some things that set an expectation for me in games. The first thing that I always look for when looking at a design is the designer. If I am familiar with the designer, this will likely tell me some of the qualities and characteristics that will be in the game. Many times designers have a kind of a design philosophy that they put into their games, regardless of the weight of the game or the mechanisms that are used. So, for example, Feld, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, he always has some kind of interesting action selection mechanism. So the way in which you do the things in the game is always clever and always interesting. So if I see Feld's on the box, I know that most likely he's going to have some kind of interesting action selection mechanism in the game. And that kind of sets an expectation for me going into a Feld design. If there is a really dull and boring action selection mechanism in a Feld game, that would be a disappointment for me. But if there is an interesting action selection mechanism, I feel like for me, because I am expecting that, when I look for it and find it and experience it, that expectation enhances my enjoyment of the game. You know, I experience the mechanism and I go, oh, there it is. That's what I was looking for. Love it. Right? And it just kind of enhances that for me. The second thing that influences my expectation of a game is the publisher. Different publishers are known for different things, different qualities. You know, if I am getting a CMON game, I can be pretty sure that I'm going to get, you know, some kind of cool miniature or just, you know, some kind of produced components. If I pick up a Capstone game, I know that I'm going to be getting something with deep gameplay, probably a challenging game, something that's going to test my wits. So publishers, you know, some of them, you know, if I'm buying a Fantasy Flight game, who knows what I'm going to get. I'm probably going to get some kind of licensed IP. So if I get a game from a certain publisher, many times that sets some kind of expectation for me. The next thing is box art. A lot of times I depend on the box art to give me an indication of what the game is going to be like or who the game is trying to appeal to. You know, if it's like the white European dude that's upset, it's probably going to be a crunchy Euro. If it has really colorful wizards on the front, it's probably going to be some kind of thematic card game or dungeon crawler or, you know, whatever. Usually the box art gives you some indication of what kind of game you're getting. The components are another aspect of games that set up some kind of expectation. If I see dice in a game, I know that that's either a source of input randomness, output randomness, or some kind of counter. You know, if there's a whole bunch of wooden cubes, I probably know what that means. If there's little miniatures, you know, generally I know there's going to be some fighting or it's going to be kind of a dudes on a map kind of game. The components set up some kind of expectation for the type of game. Obviously, the mechanisms or the core mechanisms of the game. If, you know, it's a deck builder, I kind of have an idea of what that experience is going to be like. If it's a worker placement game, I kind of have an idea of what that experience is going to be like. If it's a drafting game or you know, whatever, you kind of get a general idea for what kind of game you are getting. And then a lot of times I'll look at the BGG weight for a game before I pick it up, and that helps me know what I'm getting into going into a game. If it's a, you know, a 4, I know that it's going to be a heavy experience. And so looking at that weight can kind of set up an expectation for me. Now, all of these things are generalizations or stereotypes or you know, whatever. They're generalities, right? And so games break these expectation creators all the time. And that's what this whole discussion is about. Games that do not play as they seem like they would. It's interesting because I do think that, especially for me, just my personality and how I engage with things, I feel like expectation is really important, like I said, because it enhances my enjoyment of a thing. But if you're able to surprise me in a positive way, you may have just done something even better than meeting the expectation, right? You've almost exceeded the expectation, depending on what it is, right? So I just wanted to talk about a few games that kind of broke these expectations that I had for the games going into them, and what that was like, what my response was like to that experience, maybe how that changed my outlook or expectations or maybe prejudices for certain types of games. So the first one that I wanted to mention was Scythe. And a lot of people have talked about this since the game has come out, but you know, you have this box art, so this is going to the box art, with like these huge mechs on it, and the vibe that I had was like, all right, we're going to get in these mechs, and we're going to blow some crap up, and we're going to be fighting, there's going to be lots of conflict, you know, it's almost going to be one of these Risk-esque kind of war control kind of games, but it is not that at all. I mean, for those of you that have played this game, like, you know that, yeah, you can do some fighting if you want to, but like, you can win the game without fighting at all. And this one was kind of a, like, I'm not sure how I felt about the breaking of that expectation. Like, I enjoyed the game, and I think that it's a good game, but I don't know, I don't know if I would have marketed it the way that it was in terms of the game art, but it wasn't a negative surprise, but it also wasn't necessarily a positive surprise either. I think I was going into the game wanting to blow some stuff up, and I didn't get to, really. I think I, like, fought somebody or engaged in combat, like, once or twice, but I ended up enjoying the game. It just wasn't what I was expecting, and I don't know. I'm not sure if I would have preferred it the other way, but it definitely did not meet my expectation. It deceived me. Another game that deceived me was Gloomhaven. So, you know, I had heard all about Gloomhaven and how amazing it was. You know, there was lots of hype for it, and I was like, oh yeah, it's just another campaign dungeon crawler co-op game. Like, I'm just not into it, don't care. But the guys had played it, and they invited me to come play a session with them, and they, like, had all the crazy, like, app-assisted stuff, and all the monsters, the enemies' hit points were all tracked via the app and all that stuff, so it wasn't as fiddly as it could be without all that stuff. But I was very pleasantly surprised with Gloomhaven because they did not go with the normal, you know, chuck some dice, get some hits and some misses kind of combat, which is generally, you know, that's the combat is kind of the main focus in a lot of dungeon crawl games. But they went with this very clever, very thinky card system, and it just, like, I haven't played it since. I don't even know if the other guys have played it either, but that one experience I had, I was like, dude, this is sick. Like, if I'm gonna play a dungeon crawl game, it's gonna be this one, because this card system is just so interesting, and it totally broke my expectation of what a dungeon crawl game is, and definitely for the better. So that was an example of, like, the expectation was that I'm not going to like this game because of this and this, and I ended up loving it. And so it kind of went outside of the realm of what you would normally get with a dungeon crawl game, and it was awesome. That's, you know, probably why it's number one on BGG. It breaks boundaries and does something new, and it surprises people, and it's just, it's wonderful. Another game that kind of exceeded or went around my expectations was this game called Sentient, designed by J. Alex Kevern, who, if you don't know that name, he designed Gold West, which is a phenomenal game. And Sentient was put out by Renegade Games. And Renegade is a publisher that's really hit or miss with me. Probably more on the miss side. But Sentient, a friend of the podcast, Mr. Searles, he had this game and was like, dude, you gotta try this. It's a good game. And I looked at the box art, saw it was by Renegade, and I was like, nah. And I like tried to, you know, ignore it and you know, tried to shuffle around it and play something else. Well, eventually he got us to play it. It's a dice game, which was another thing that when he told me that, I was like, this, I'm literally going to hate this whole thing. He finally got us to play it. Dode. This game is good. It's very, very thinky, very mathy. Like you're moving these dice, like, you know, flipping them to different values and trying to fit cards into slots based on the dice that are like on the right and left side of them. And it's just really like puzzly, really thinky. Like this game, maybe more than any other game that I've ever played, just totally blew my expectations out of the water. And because it was able to do that, like, I may be giving it more credit than what it deserves, but like, I love this game because of its ability to totally deceive me and totally give me an experience that I was not expecting in a really good way. Now, obviously, some people are going to play that game and be really disappointed because they're looking for some kind of, you know, lighter, and I mean, it's a pretty light game, I guess, but it just, in the weight that it is, it's so thinky, I thought. And, you know, some people might play that and be really disappointed. Maybe they were looking for a dice chucker with, you know, because there's like this cyborg, it's in like a sci-fi setting. Maybe they're looking for this, you know, cyborg dice rolling crazy thing, and they are going to be disappointed by that. So that's another interesting point of discussion, is that how expectation plays into a game obviously very much depends on the player, and it's very relative to those playing the game. And so the last game that I wanted to mention is a game that I have yet to play, but I really want to, just to experience it. But Merlin, a game by Stefan Feld, so one of my favorite designers, or at least a designer that I really, really respect and enjoy his work. But it is essentially a roll and move design. And I think, so because of the designer, they were like, oh, this new Stefan Feld game is coming out, you know, Merlin. And people are like, yeah, it's, you know, it's like, it uses the roll and move mechanism. And people are like, nah, dog. And they're like, no, it really does. And then, you know, you have this expectation of, oh my gosh, if Stefan Feld's doing a roll and move game, like, it's going to be sick. He's going to redeem the roll and move mechanism, and it's going to be awesome. But then it seemed like a lot of people played it, and their expectation was wrecked, but in a not good way. And they're like, dog, it's a roll and move game, like, with some sparkles on it, and I don't like it. And so, you know, that's a bummer. But that's a game that I want to check out that I'm just curious to experience. So here's my takeaway from this. I think that expectation can be a really useful tool in giving players a really good experience. If they know what to expect, and then you meet that expectation, you're going to be, you know, winning over that player, right? You will have succeeded with that design. If you want to surprise people, I think that that's totally okay. But I think that it's very important to some degree, market your game to people that when they experience the surprise, those types of people will enjoy the surprise. So for example, I have decided to self-publish my designs, at least for the foreseeable future. I'm not going to limit myself to only self-publishing, but I have a vision for kind of a brand and a setting in which all of my games can take place in. So almost think Ryan Lockett and Red Raven Games, kind of like what he does with his brand and how many of his games, if not all of them, I guess, fit into the same setting and the same world. And it's going to be a very bright and a very colorful world and a whimsical world. That's kind of my keyword, whimsical. But the gameplay is going to be very deep. I'm going to lean towards complexity. I'm going to lean towards the heavier end of the weight scale. Some of the games may be brutal. And so what I'm saying is that the art style and the setting may not necessarily fit into the kind of design, the kind of art direction that is typical with mechanisms and game systems of this nature. And so in that sense, it may come as a surprise. The gameplay may come as a surprise to people who play the games because of the aesthetic. And so I am going to try to market the games towards people who are going to really enjoy the mechanisms and systems so that when they are surprised by the game, it is a positive surprise instead of a negative surprise. I don't want to necessarily market it to people that may enjoy the aesthetic but are going to hate the mechanisms. Obviously, you know, a lot of what I'm talking about right now is, like I said, kind of generalities, and there's a lot of theories in here, and some of what I'm saying may not even be complete coherent thoughts, but I think it's an interesting thing to think about and talk about. Surprises can be good, but make sure you're surprising the right people. And I think going into a game as just a player, know a little bit about what you're getting into. Because I really believe that expectation can make or break the game for you. If you're expecting one thing and you're really excited about that one thing and it's not that, you very well could be bummed. But if you're expecting something negative about a game and the game surprises you, that could be a really good thing. And if you are expecting something really good and that really good thing happens just as you expected, that also is a really good thing. And if you're expecting it to be garbage and it is garbage, then I don't know why you played it. Anyways, I would love to hear your thoughts on this topic. Therefore, I'm going to be creating a blog entry with this podcast in it, and I'll probably do this for all the podcasts going forward, just so that there is a place for you to leave your thoughts about a specific podcast episode. So I'll put the link to that in the show notes, so that you can easily find it and leave comments about this episode. Otherwise, that is all that I have for you tonight. Our topic for next episode is going to be some of our favorite mechanisms. We're going to be talking about maybe what I would consider favorite genres of games, and then underneath that, some of our favorite mechanisms that would fit into those genres. So that should be a light, fun discussion, and you guys will get to know myself and any of the co-hosts that are available. You'll get to know us a little bit better and some of our tastes a little bit more, and we'll get to maybe share some of our favorite games that include those mechanisms and fall within those genres. Go ahead and please check out the blog. There's lots of great written content there, hexandcube.com. Please join our mailing list. That's going to be increasingly valuable to me and to you as things develop with the blog and with the podcast and with my game designs. And so I would love to be able to send you some regular updates. And there will be a newsletter that I send out at the beginning of each month. And so you can be on the lookout for that if you get signed up. Also, make sure you go check me out on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. I'd love to hear from you. Send me a message, comment on any of my stuff, and I will respond and get back to you. And we can chat. We can talk about cool stuff like board games and food and family and whatever else you'd like to talk about. Thank you again so much for joining me tonight. I hope that you enjoyed it. I hope you got something out of it. And please join me again next time. Catch you later on the flip side. Chicka chicka wow.